Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I think there's kind of a fundamental decision people get to make about the role that religion, in the broadest sense of the term, plays in the modern world. For some people, once we enter into the world of science and rationality and representational government and modernity and the Enlightenment or whatever you want to call it, once we make that move, we start to leave religion behind us and we have to deal with these issues as rational beings, trying to make sense of a world that may be random, that may have no guiding hand, and that this is really the proper way to understand our modern condition, that we've like left these things in the dust and we're just trying to figure it out on our own. And then there's sort of another another road to take, which is the one that I take, which is the stuff never leaves, and that however much you want to pretend that we have entered into a radically different situation. I mean, obviously, all these things have happened and they're part of reality in some ways. But that the idea that we've entered into a radically new world actually obscures a lot of very important things and hoodwinks us, actually, more. We think we're being more rational, but actually we're stuck in certain desires, fantasies, drives, intuitions, epiphanies. How many different ways of talking about the ways in which religion and what we would think of as the supernatural, of mysticism, of the occult, linger on and continue to transform even our contemporary supposedly scientific and rational world. Of course, I wrote a whole book, Technosis, about this in terms of technology culture. But really the easiest example of this issue is the new atheist, Richard Dawkins and crew. Because from inside, the narrative of the new atheist is that nobody has thrown off the shackles of religion and fuzzy thinking more than they have. They are the ne plus ultra. Nobody's going to out-secularize their force of secularity. And they spend all their time attacking religion, attacking fuzzy thinking, don't even accommodate religion. That's intellectually suspicious and to be avoided. So they're extreme rationalists, extreme skeptics, extreme secular. And yet, if you know anything about the history of religion, and particularly the history of Protestantism and Protestant revolt, the dissenters, all of the crazy Protestant sects and the militancy with which Protestants have gone after the falsehoods and the untruths that need to be expunged from the human civilization in order for it to be godly and pure. It's so obvious that the new atheists are just running on old religious scripts. So as a historian of religion, it's funny. It's just like you look at another guy who knows this stuff and you're like, these guys are hilarious. They have no idea what they're doing. They look like they're secular, but they act like they're religious freaks. So for me, that's a very clear line in the road. And I'm firmly convinced that we have to take account of these major narratives, of these strange intuitions, these altered states, all of the sort of bric-a-brac of our history as a sometimes supernatural, sometimes occult, sometimes mystical, sometimes religious people in order to understand the present. And that's true not just about science or medicine is a place where it comes up a lot, or psychiatry, which comes up a lot, but also about politics and even about the economy. One of the more interesting discussions that's grown up over the last, 15, 20 years, is looking at contemporary politics and even economics through the lens of religion, starting to understand how, our supposedly secular order is actually built on religious presuppositions and religious forms of power and religious forms of faith, and that even the faith I have that when I give my money to the bank that they're going to be able to give it back to me, and the fiduciary relationship we've established really goes back, if you think about it, about fundamental elements of trust and fidelity that come, not unchanged, but in some ways unbroken from an era of when religion played that role. So it's a fascinating way of looking at our contemporary world when everything is, you know, so up for grabs and so terrifying, to not pretend that we have left the framework of religion, even if personally we are secular people. And my guest today has done a very fresh and fascinating version of this approach to contemporary political economy from a religious or sort of, frankly, kind of more occult element in talking about neoliberalism in his new book, Politics of Divination, Neoliberal Endgame and the Religion of Contingency. Joshua Ramey, who's a friend of mine and a professor of philosophy at Grinnell, talks about how divination, which we really think of, you know, your average secular person really thinks we've left in the dust. They don't even think about it anymore. You need to go over to the hippie folks and their tarot cards and, you know, I Ching readings to find contemporary examples of divination. But of course, most people practice some form of divination until only recently. And the closer you look at it, the more you realize that, once again, secular, supposedly rational people also practice their own forms of divination. And in this book, which is really, which is dense but very worthwhile, Ramey argues that it's really divination in a way that it helps explain the way in which chance, contingency, oh tough luck, functions in our neoliberal order. So it's a great argument. We're going to spend the hour unpacking it with one of my favorite people to talk to, Joshua Ramey. Hey, Joshua, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Great to be here, Eric. Thank you for having me on.
Great, great. Well, I thought one way to talk about it was just to start and talk about divination a little bit more. You know, I know you researched a great deal for this project, and since in a way it's a little bit easier to get a handle on, at least to some degree, what were some of the things you found out about, you know, human cultures in general, or you know, some of the larger patterns that go along with divination? Why has it been so important for human civilizations?
Yeah, sure. So the sort of scholarly, you know, generalization that you find in the literature that keeps cropping up, whether you're looking at, you know, anthropological or historical or, you know, religious studies of of divination, is you find that it's basically a very generic phenomenon where groups of people or individuals, but typically groups, recognize certain rituals or certain practices that are usually tradition-bound, time-honored in some way, by means of which the community can render chance meaningful or render contingency tractable. You know, why is a storm coming up right now? Is there something we can do to get a handle on why a particular person is ill in our community and not another one? Is there something we can find out about the elk herd, if we're living, you know, in places where we need to survive that way, to find out how many we should kill this year? And all of these kinds of questions that are basically, you know, unanswerable on empirical grounds, or, you know, even on the basis of very rich experience of a particular place, are the kinds of questions that traditionally would be put to various kinds of divination. Whether this is, you know, everything from scapulomancy, which is a divination by shoulder bones that is common in a lot of places in the Northern Hemisphere, Siberia, in among the Inuits in Alaska, divination using cowrie shells in the Ifa tradition that comes out of Yoruban peoples, and then other kinds of divination practices that involve going into trance states, music and dancing. So there's an enormous range of ways that divination is done, and a huge range of kinds of questions that are attempted to be answered. But one of the most interesting things that I found out in my research is that, you know, far from being something that is, just important for the history of non-Western or non-modern societies, the earliest democratic experiments in Greece used the drawing of lots to determine who was going to participate in the assembly. The Romans had elaborate and extensive divination techniques for determining whether to go to war, or even in some very difficult judicial cases, you know, what the penalties should be. And this pervades, like you were saying, even the modern era, you know, after the scientific revolution. Bible-believing Christians who aren't even supposed to practice divination, really, even though scripture is a little bit conflicted about this, you know, will practice bibliomancy, which is, you know, where you don't know what to do in your life and crack open the Bible and let your finger fall on a word. That's, you know, a still very common individual practice. But even at, you know, the state level, there's still a law on the books in Arizona that I think it's if it's a race for mayor, some kind of government office. But if it turns out to be a tie, then it's all elections that end in an exact tie. They have to be decided by cartomancy, which is, you know, whoever draws the higher card from the deck wins the race.
Yeah, it's funny because this it really, you know, it flies in the face of basic kind of secular post-scientific revolution mind thinking. I mean, even more than the idea that, you know, maybe there's a God behind it all who, you know, created the DNA code and let the whole thing run or something like that. That's so abstract. You can kind of approach it from different angles, but the idea that a throw of coins or the pattern of cracks on a bone would tell you any information about nature really is an affront to that kind of just sort of basic, rational scientific mind frame. And yet it seems to be as deeply woven into us as any sort of, non-scientific way of thinking, so much so that rather than thinking of it as something that gets expunged from our world, is thinking of it as something that gets transformed. And probably the best example of that is, of course, gambling, right? I mean, isn't the history of gambling like intimately woven with the history of divination?
Yeah, I was about to go there next. The book on this was written by a historian at Rutgers named Jackson Lears. And his book is called Something for Nothing on Luck in America. And it's this incredible history focusing on the United States, but it's really relevant to, you know, kind of global perspectives too, because pretty much every single modern gambling game derives from a divination technique, whether this is dice or cards or roulette or whatever. And Lears makes some really amazing observations, I think, about American culture in particular, where there's a very long tradition of a kind of tension between two very different views of providence, some sort of, you know, divine action in the world. And one is this kind of, you know, upper class sort of liberal Protestant view that, you know, is ultimately behind the kind of new atheism that you were talking about in your introduction, this kind of secularizing, rationalizing tendency that comes out of Protestantism. And on this view, you know, the way to solicit divine favor and be in touch with the divine order in things is to kind of engage in rational planning, right? This is sort of how, you know, the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and so on got their fortunes, as they, you know, they engaged their energy in a way that was rational and ordered and so on. And they said they thought that that was what accounted for their economic success. But there's a counter tradition to this that is worked out in the gambling halls and in the dark corners of the United States. And very interestingly, it's a much more racially mixed and much more religiously diverse and even gender diverse kind of almost utopian space where everyone becomes somehow equalized by the possibility of the breaks going in their favor. And here there's a very different idea about how to become successful, how to solicit divine favor. And it's a place where chance gets associated very strongly, even identified with grace, that chance and divine grace become almost the same thing in this kind of lower class perspective that's not part of this official, work hard, pull your bootstraps up, get ahead mentality, but that's incredibly important in American culture in particular, but also, of course, for, surviving capitalism in general. If there aren't lucky breaks around, who among us, at least anymore, really believes that, rational planning will get us where we need to go?
Well, what I love about this is such a rich set of ideas, is that I think that all of us can see this inside ourselves. Like, it's right off that we can see the contradiction in ourselves. Like, the idea that, that's widespread, among, old American families and immigrant families, that, one great thing about the United States, if you come here and you work hard and you focus and you, think about your options and you're aggressive and you work tough, you'll be able to do all right, and you might even really make it. So we have this sense that, like, it's a great opportunity just to kind of lean in and work hard and focus and all that kind of thing, which is involved with a sort of rational application. We can even think about how people promote stuff online, since that's such a common thing now. It's like there's all these ways to, like, rationalize your process. You need to be on all the social networks. There are tools and techniques to kind of scam the search rankings on Google so that your thing comes up sooner. And there's all of these ways of, like, using your networks to try to get a viral video or some new, piece of advertising that you're putting out take off. And so there's all these tricks and tools, and there are experts who will tell us how to do it, blah, 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 blah. But at the same time, we kind of sense that there's something about American culture, or the culture that we live in, that is like that just leans in and selects winners. And then we get to look at them and go, wow, look at that person. They're a celebrity, or like they did it. They made it. And we might appreciate on the one hand that they were applied and rational and this and that. But I think we all feel emotionally at least as much that there's some way in which the hand of God, however we think about that, luck, the exigencies of the market, whatever it is, that they crossed over, and the video went viral, not because they had all of this technology or all these algorithms running on their side, but they just hit it at the right time. And there's that extra juice, like winning the lottery or becoming a celebrity for no reason, that we all want too. So yeah. I think even in this really simple way, we are deeply conflicted. And it's those conflicts that you're talking about that are really behind this deep psychological relationship we have with our whole economic order, with the way in which winners and losers work out in the kind of neoliberal order.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe that's a good place to start talking a little bit about what's specific about neoliberalism and why this tension, I think, really becomes exacerbated and intensified in this, however you want to frame it, but the last 30 or 40 years, of capitalist culture. And I think it has to do partly with Friedrich Hayek's idea about what kinds of things markets are. And This is something very important to talk about because, you know, Friedrich Hayek is pretty much the intellectual godfather of neoliberalism, and he had a very particular idea about why markets were so important, not just for economic, but for politics, for social life.
Hey, Joshua, before we go to Hayek, who again is super key, everybody's got to know, can we just do a little drop on, you know, we can talk about capitalism, we can talk about neoliberalism. Neoliberalism is a particular organization of capitalism that has dominated our reality for the last handful of decades. Can you give us a little bit of like how it differs from like when, you know, when Marx talks about capitalism, he's talking about something. You talk about neoliberalism, it involves capitalism, but there are other elements of it that are kind of specific to its logic. And could you just say some of the most important ones for us to keep in mind?
Yeah, sure. So maybe the person that contrasts it with is not so much Marx, but Adam Smith, right? So Adam Smith, you know, is a sort of great, you know, ideological godfather of capitalism and of capitalist societies, and very famous for the idea of the invisible hand, that, you know, the great thing about market-based societies where we interact with one another primarily by buying and selling to one another, by trying to, you know, buy as cheaply as possible and sell as expensive as we can, is because we can organize at least some of our social life around our self-interest, that we can appeal to one another's self-interest. And if there's enough awareness of who is in the market and what's available, what supply is, what demand is, that there'll be enough transparency that nobody can really rip one another off past a certain point, and there'll be a kind of equilibrium formed from that, and, you know, a relatively stable social order. Now, the difference between Adam Smith's vision of capitalism and what we call neoliberalism, which I was indexing to Friedrich Hayek, is that Adam Smith thought it was very important to recognize that there were a lot of aspects of society that shouldn't be governed in and through market transactions. He didn't think that the military of the various nations should have anything to do with markets or market forces or private contracting and so on. He didn't think education or healthcare should be determined by you know, prices on an open market. He was you know, somebody who, if he showed up now, you know, in a debate, would look like a kind of bleeding heart liberal, you know, because the neoliberals gathering around people like Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig von Mises in the first few years after the Second World War, they were arguing against the rise of what they saw as a kind of state socialism that was really the kind of consensus in the Western world, you know, Western European world, the United States, that is usually associated with the thinking of John Maynard Keynes, that there should be a strong state that intervenes, that limits the power of markets, that you know, protects labor to some extent, and that you know, has progressive tax structures to, you know, produce a lot of social benefits without everything being privatized. But the neoliberals thought that this was a mistake, and that what we really needed to do was unleash the power of markets and market-like interactions in every area of social life. And this argument, for various interesting reasons, started to win in the 1970s, and especially with the 1980s, the rise of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, trickle-down economics, supply-side economics, the unleashing of financial markets, the lowering of barriers to the free movement of capital around the globe. All these things were an attempt to basically put more and more and more of human social life under the aegis of markets, under the aegis of buying and selling. And really what happens is that prices become the primary form of information that we look at when we go to determine, you know, what's succeeding, what's failing, what should be taken seriously, what should not. So that really what you have is with the era we live in now under neoliberalism is a kind of tyranny of profit and profitability over all other values, and that pervades, you know, everything now: healthcare, education, what to do about environmental crises, and so on.
Yeah, you know, it's such a funny thing because I'm just taking me personally here. It's taken me a long time until actually only recently that I've really connected the dots on this, and I'm kind of anticipating where we're going to go now, because I, you know, growing up in this era and being a progressive politics and studying, you know, whatever leftist and liberal critiques of the market in school and thinking all that, you know, and it just seemed like that kind of mind frame, that sort of Thatcherite Reagan worldview, was just something that I had nothing to do with in my own personal life. Like, it was just not a position that I was taking. But the more that I dug into the roots of this worldview, where did the faith come from that markets are really the best way to do things? Because, yeah, a lot of people are doing it just because they're making money, but there has to be some kind of ideological substratum. There's a reason that people were able to make these arguments and to set up these structures. And the more I dug into it, the more I realized actually there are elements in that thinking, particularly through Hayek, who was, you know, the Austrian school, which are really the source of these kind of libertarian free market ideas, that some of his inspiration were things that were extremely deep to me, like Taoism.
Yep. You know,
which, yeah. I thought, what does Taoism have to do with yeah. Milton Friedman and the free market and all these creeps? And yeah. It actually turns out that there's a really interesting connection. So that's kind of a setup to you, but it's a fun way of thinking about it.
Well, yeah, this takes me back to the point I was making before you asked me to set it up better, which, you know, thanks for that. But the Hayek contrasts two kinds of social order. One he calls taxis, is a Greek word, taxis, and the other one, and we get words like taxonomy in English from this. And it's kind of a wooden, kind of not very flexible, kind of stiff, brittle form of order that he associated with socialism and with the need to have lots of committees and, you know, take lots of time making deliberations about the future that would probably turn out to be wrong 2 seconds later. And then he contrasts that with another form of order he calls cosmos. Cosmos, K-O-S-M-O-S. Of course, we get cosmic from that. But he literally thinks that when you organize social life through markets, you tap into the same kind of creativity and generativity that's in nature itself. He really thought that markets were second nature, and that the kind of moves that we make when we're interacting on the market are intuitive. They're in that flow, that Taoist way that, you know, you invoked there for a minute. And he really praises not so much rational planning, and this is the part that's confusing. Because it seems like, you know, your average neoliberal would be some very successful businessman with a great business plan, but actually Hayek says the most successful person in a social order that's you know, totally market saturated is going to be this person he calls the man on the spot. And the man on the spot is basically the person who is like your character you invoked on social media, who is in this flow of information and is kind of using her animal spirits to reach into the trends and to affect and be affected by others in this super dynamic way, where you know, it's literally as if she's channeling what the market wants, and it's as if, you know, the market, as Philip Murawski puts it, is this kind of meta information processor or meta mind that somehow knows better than everyone involved, and yet there are certain kinds of people who are the geniuses or the oracles or whatever, you know, that that can sort of feel their way into this this flow. And that's where you start to see that the neoliberal ideal for the ideal, you know, kind of person or agent is this kind of weird synthesis of that person who plays by chance and is somehow completely surrendered to this emerging order, which retroactively seems to be, you know, a kind of destiny that was somehow there all along. So there's a really strange there's a really strange kind of heady, almost religious but definitely spiritual kind of thinking in Hayek about the market. And you're right. I think you can see it abundantly in the way that people try to position themselves in, you know, in what's left of opportunities in our day and age.
Well, what's amazing about this to me is that, you know, unless you actually study economics and unless you particularly want to study the roots of it, you know, not just how it works, but like, where do these ideas come from? And, you know, I got going, you know, I read Milton Friedman when I was a kid just to be a punk, you know, whatever, you know, just to like take a weird, like something so stodgy that whatever. But, you know, it took a long time of being interested in anarchism and the history of libertarianism and I was interested in libertarianism in the United States and where it came from, because in some ways I'm a social libertarian. So it's like, where does this stuff come from? And realizing that these ideas were really, they're quite resonant with these, again, these other dimensions, not just maybe an occult interest in divination practices, but also the idea of order out of chaos. You know, like a lot of people, I was really turned on by these ideas, by fractal geometry and the, you know, and the work of Prigogine and the system science that sort of said, no, in order to understand how reality works, you have to understand it as a complex system. And some systems, they don't need any outside guidance, that the systems themselves spontaneously produce order. And we see this in social movements and, you know, anarcho-syndicalist gatherings and the dynamics of collective houses, like all these wonderful things that quote-unquote liberals or progressives are into, including system science, including ecology, have this notion of spontaneous order. So to find that this free market stuff has that explicit, a kind of metaphysics, a kind of, again, ultimately, I believe, a kind of spirituality of trusting nature, but additionally trusting that nature is fully expressed in the market, yes, which is it requires more work to do. Well, that, you know, it makes things make more sense, though, like why there's this kind of weird, insane passion for something that's so clearly ruining so many people's lives, not even to mention the earth.
Right. So the key for me is that neoliberalism has been able to equate markets with those broader ecological and systemic dynamics that you invoke there, and that Hayek invokes too. And they're, of course, very fascinated by, you know, information science and, you know, complexity in biology and so on. But at the end of the day, it's a quite reductionist view of order, because there really is one and only one engine running the entire the entire ecology, and that's the engine of competition. The idea is that unless you ruthlessly reduce all of your other values to the desire to beat the competition, to get what you want as opposed to what someone else wants, then this particular order doesn't function. And of course, it's not efficient, it doesn't clear, there's all these economic ways of talking about it, right? But the massive effort of neoliberalism, and this is where it gets very pernicious and very dangerous, I think you'll agree, has been to try to instill in human society, in you know, American culture and Western culture in particular, not so much the idea that greed is good, but that greed is the only thing that is real, that some kind of competitive, ruthless, you know, drive to outdo and dominate and destroy the other is really the only active force in an ecology. And they, of course, think that this is just rooted back in something like, you know, a drive in nature to compete. And of course, what I would argue is that they're ignoring the entire, you know, symbiotic and empathic ground in nature upon which something like competition is a mere figure. I mean, that's a larger argument. But, you know, in my view, I mean, the ecological crisis is very much the most obvious symptom, or maybe along with the mental health crisis, of the fact that that markets aren't second nature at all, and that this idea that greed or competitiveness or prudence, which is the Adam Smith term for it, is the only, you know, agent force, the only reality, is not only one sided, but it's suicidal. It's nihilistic. Right.
It's like there's two sides. One is to make the assumption that these kind of human processes, which involve power and institutions and all these things that don't really exactly resemble, an ecology the way that we think about it in terms of the environment, that the idea that those things are pure expressions of nature is already goofy. But even if they are, even if markets are showing us something about the spontaneous order that we see in other systems, which they kind of do. I mean, there's something to all of these arguments. And of course, it wouldn't be capitalism if it wasn't partly true. That's part of the problem. But it's still a bad model of nature. That's not how, you know, you have to have symbiotic elements if you're going to describe how something like a human, I mean, a not human, but a planetary ecology comes to be. You can't get there just with some pure Darwinian, social Darwinian idea of the competition. It doesn't, I think people increasingly recognize that, even very, you know, mainstream or conservative, you know, neo-Darwinists who are so still into that structure. So it's not even very good, ecology, but it also keys in something really particular with our psychologies. And that's kind of also what's interesting about your argument, is you're not just saying, look, you know, a lot of people criticize the Austrian school, and there's a lot of things to be said about it, and it doesn't really matter because the guys in power are still just like cramming it down our throats. It almost seems like it's sort of too late to turn back, but I don't want to think too it's that negatively. But you're also talking about something psychological or kind of below the surface, if you will, in terms of how we experience our own contingency and our own a precarity in this situation where we don't know where our, you know, next gig is coming from, and we're like, we're an Uber driver, and oh God, we got a 3-star, so now we're going to go down to a different level, and they're going to give us different rides. It's everything is so precarious, so flexible in a cruel way, that there's something about that whole order that's keying off this divinatory sensibility that on some level we all still have.
Yeah. Well, the first time I noticed that was maybe 5 years ago. Wasn't that long after the 2008 financial crisis, maybe 2010, 2011. And I was at a wedding of some friends of mine up in Vermont. And it was, you know, a beautiful wedding, lots of interesting people around. And there was kind of a crew of you know, mid-20 to early 30-somethings who had come up from Brooklyn. They were, you know, friends of the bride. And we were just hanging out by the fire and talking, and I remember just, you know, chatting people up and figuring out what they were up to and this and that. I remember there was this extreme reluctance that anyone had to say exactly what they did. They would say, oh yeah, I do a little catering, I do some production work, I do screen printing, I have a blog, you know. But it was incredibly uncool of me, you know, to ask, you know, what do you do, or, you know, what's your thing? And it was like a cipher to me of our era, right? Because they wanted to be hyper flexible. They wanted to also, I think, even in that moment, sense their way into who might be looking for what in that moment. So there's this kind of continuous, kind of divinatory, informally divinatory, ciphering off one another that I could feel very intensely you know, and I feel, you know, in my students especially too, that yeah, it's you know, sort of like very dangerous to get yourself pigeonholed into anything, because of course, you know, the markets are changing and collapsing so quickly. You got to be able to be, you know, hyper flexible.
I mean, and one of the points you're making about divination is that the reason it exists, as you say, it lends meaning to chance. And one of the things you talk about when you look at the you know, anthropology of divination, when you look at the way it functions in societies today, but also historically, is that as much as it's about predicting the future, what's going to happen, which is kind of the way we normally think about it, you know, let's throw the tarot cards to find out what's going to happen or something like that. That more of the time, it's actually about coming up with a story about why things that have already happened the way they did. So it provides meaning for the contingency, the randomness, if you will, that we have already undergone, you know, in our experience or in the experience of the village or the cult, you know, the elk didn't show up this year or I didn't get the job or whatever it is. And what you're saying is that rather than, you know, turning to these sort of poetic, if somewhat baroque systems, what people do now is they rationalize contingency and randomness by thinking about the market. Well, that's just how the market is. That's just what it's like to live, you know, in our era of freedom or whatever you want to say.
Well, there's a really interesting lesson in this that I learned from a friend of mine who worked for a Wall Street consultant for a while doing monthly interviews of traders. And, you know, they basically, you know, just sort of check in with the traders and ask them, you know, about their strategies and so on. And apparently, almost without fail, if the trader had a good month and was, you know, successful, he or she would have a story ready about, oh yeah, it's these are the strategies I used and this was how I did it and this was the techniques I used and so on. But if it was a losing period and things weren't going so well, the trader would just sort of throw up her hands and say, well, you know, it's the market. And I think this is a really interesting thing to look at too, because when we're successful, right, everybody wants to know what our story was and what we did, you know, on the hope that there's some kind of strategy we can replicate, right? But then when things go badly, right, you know, it's as if we can just say, oh, well, you know, it just wasn't meant to be or something like this. And the real downside of that, I think, and the extremely pernicious thing politically, right, is that anytime anyone is seen to be a loser or to have been, you know, unsuccessful or to have failed in some way, right, we can immediately, you know, individualize and personalize. We can turn that person into a kind of scapegoat. Like there must be some curse or some stain on that person that made him or her unfit for the great movement of the market. You know, the you're not among the survivors. You know, and you see this played out horribly in the way that you know entire places like New Orleans, you know, are just left behind. Oh, it was hit with a hurricane. Well, too bad. There's only so much we can do for those people. You know, we go down there and give them 30 or 40% loans, you know, but once you've been sort of marked as damaged goods, it's as if there's no coming back, you know. And I think this is a really terrifying thing about the world that we live in, is that it's become a kind of, you know, people call it cannibal capitalism or, you know, vulture capitalism, but it seems as if the fadedness cuts much harder against the losers than ever before.
Yeah, and it's funny how that part of the psychology of that is that the losers in some ways have to be, you know, scapegoated as opposed to simply even just ignored. Like there has to be kind of a sense that there's something to expunge, because the truth of the losers, at least some of the time or a lot of the time, is reminds us that if we're winners, that we won because of, for contingent reasons too.
Exactly.
So they remind us of the lie that I got here because I was just I was rational and I applied this and blah blah blah, and not because my family could afford to send me to this school or because I was raised in whatever. There's all these other factors that go on into what makes some people enabled to succeed. And yeah, some people are really brilliant and they figure something out and they have a breakthrough or they make an invention or whatever it is. Sure, that happens and it's wonderful and creative. But the vast majority of people are there for a very thickly mixed amount of luck and, you know, individual go get them. But that is so challenging to this ideology, this sense we have about ourselves, who we are personally, and this is how we actually feel about ourselves. It's not just an abstract idea. It's the way that we are taught to feel in this society, that in order to maintain that fiction or fabulation, we have to denigrate the losers. We have to see them as being somehow different than us.
Yeah, and it really contrasts with what you have in some traditional societies that use divination to, you know, to maintain social order. I'm thinking of, for instance, among the Azande, which was an East African people group that Evans Pritchard famously studied, but that, you know, others have looked at too and done further work on. But there's a fascinating thing that goes on there where if someone has been, accused of sorcery, maybe for making someone else sick or making someone else impotent or something like this, if the diviners discover that's true and the people corroborate it, and that's another interesting thing, is that there's a lot of kind of social contestation around these practices, and it isn't as if, you know, it's automatic or mechanical, which is something that I think, unfortunately, we think is true about the market. But at any rate, when that's been found out, we know you practiced sorcery and made this person sick. Almost always, as soon as that determination is made, the person is forgiven and brought back into the community. Sort of like, oh well, we know you didn't really mean it, so come back in now, you know, and let's start over. Let's press the reset button, right? And that's the thing that you don't see happening, especially in this era of capitalism, which is all about austerity. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that because education and healthcare have been so deeply monetized, because pensions are disappearing, and frankly, because people have so much less access to things like growing their own food, right? That if and when you don't succeed on the market, the consequences of that are just more severe than ever before, and they're radically unsustainable. So the fear that is, you know, driving the need to scapegoat, and I think it's a fear that you very much see playing out behind the recent election, we can talk about that if you want. But I think that that is, you know, a very real effect of the last 30 or 40 years of the gutting of all other forms of social and natural capital and their monetization, because you don't, it's like when you fall from the money making game, that there's an abyss. There isn't the other dimensions of social life that even Adam Smith recognized had to be there to really support those kind of games.
Yeah, it's reminding me of this episode of Black Mirror where everybody is, giving each other ratings, 5 stars, you know, for every interaction. So everybody has this kind of star rating, and it shows this person who, of course, is a little bit below another person who invites her to her wedding, and then all these things go wrong, and she loses her stars because of a lot of random events, contingent things, and mm-hmm. so she loses her rating. And then, of course, the whole thing, you know, it becomes immiserating and nightmarish. And I think about that even when you're just doing just something as simple as like choosing something because of the stars. And you know consciously that there's any number of reasons that things are that way, that they got written, you know, even talking to like Uber drivers who, you know, I got picked up by this Mexican dude. he had been, you know, he was from Mexico, but he was whatever. You know, you didn't think, oh, like he looks like an immigrant or whatever. He was just a guy in L.A., whatever. And he had had these like he had these racist confrontations that he explained very clearly. It was very easy to see what the problem was. And those people gave him, you know, one or two stars. And then once you lose those stars, then you start getting worse rides. So you have to drive more to make less money because you get worse rides because the system is filtering it based on your stars. And you're like, I mean, it was such a horrible feeling of this way in which the rationality of algorithms combines with contingency to judge people on whether or not they're winners or losers. I mean, it's really yeah. frightening. That I mean, not just frightening, but also ontologically disturbing, because it's sort of like this weird mixture of randomness and algorithm, you know, calculations that are out of control that nobody really controls or answers to anymore.
We're very, very confused because we historically associate those kinds of impersonal processes of calculation, right, with something that is supposed to be more democratic, that's supposed to be open to, you know, kind of processes of accountability. It's how we check people's work and see if, you know, the machines did what they were supposed to do, right? So we have all these associations with, you know, the objectivity of scientific rationalism somehow being, you know, part of what prevents authoritarianism and prevents, you know, rigid hierarchy from staying in place and prevents, you know, the same people from being in positions of power or abusing it, right? But what we're seeing here, it's being turned exactly in the opposite direction. It's a little bit how, you know, you initially start trusting your Spotify, you know, Discover Weekly algorithm to feed you new music, and then in about 3 weeks, you know, you're getting the same songs over and over again, and it's like a replication of your own playlist. You know, there's this weird way in which these you know, that what the algorithms tend to do is they reproduce a future in the image of the existing present. So that what's really happening in a certain way is that chance is being foreclosed. It's not really being solicited, but because we have this ideology that markets can and should be mediating chance to us, we can't really believe that what's happening is happening.
Yeah, that's very well said. There's something happening now. I mean, this is, you know, we're gonna have to stop talking in 2 minutes, and we're like already in this all these crazy ideas. But there's something happening to time right now. Like,
yeah.
I think our actual lived sense of time and relationship to the future as an open space of possibility is being, that whole relationship to the future as an open place is being recoded, transformed, looped, and as technology, and we're only beginning with the predictive stuff. Like, we think, no, we're getting a lot of predictive stuff down. It's like, no. We're just starting the prediction. Where that's the real source. That's the real drive of big data. Is to predict. And so, as those things become hardwired and then fed back to us, it's not just that our options are constrained, or we have a new ideology or whatever. It's that the actual feeling of being in time, in relating to an open future, changes. And I think we're in that right now, and it's a very weird time. And since we only have a couple minutes, I want to sort of go with this, but in a different direction for you finally, is that it's not about denying this divinatory side of ourselves. Mm-hmm. It's about embracing it and recognizing it in its fullness. A deep divinatory view is one that's not just linked to the limitations of the market, but recognizes the openness of the future. So talk about that, about embracing that side.
Yeah, well, I mean, the last chapter of the book is called Decolonizing Divination, because I think that in a way, if we can take even the smallest step back from this kind of really pernicious global and semi-automatic kind of divination we're trying to practice, we will find that we're in the middle of and still with an enormous number of more traditional and even improvised and newer practices of divination that are much richer and have much more of a possibility for opening up futures that we didn't even realize were there. I mean, I work a lot with the I Ching in particular, and one of my constant experiences is that I will bring a certain question to the I Ching, and if I'm paying attention, I will often find that the I Ching is actually telling me that the question I'm asking is not even the one that I should be asking. That I'm even subtly reoriented toward my whole set of expectations about what can happen by going into a divinatory space, not so much, you know, getting a yes or no answer or positive, negative answer to the question I was posing in the first place. And I think that we need to be looking for any kind of space like that where we can become temporarily, you know, vulnerable enough to ourselves and each other and to our wisdom traditions to actually find out if the questions we're asking are even the pertinent ones or relevant ones. And that's what we're not doing in capitalism, because of course the only question that we can ask is whether something's going to be profitable or not, or why something was profitable or not. And there are just a lot more interesting questions than that to ask.
I think we're going to have to end it there, Joshua. I know it almost feels like we're just getting started, but that's how it goes. So thank you so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you, Eric. Great to talk to you.
Very much so. And just to, you know, to remind everybody, Joshua's new book is on the politics of divination. So check.